morning and welcome to Central Standard Friday. I'm Monroe Dodd. Houses tell you a lot of things about the people who designed them, the folks who lived in them, the techniques and the care with which they were constructed, and the era in which they were built. In Kansas City, we're lucky to have a couple of houses still standing after more than a century and a half, and these houses speak volumes. Both were built before the Civil War by prosperous families of that era. Both have been restored. They're not only open to the public, they welcome the public. One is on Warnell Road in the 6100 block, the imposing farm mansion of John Warnell. The other is a few miles south and west at State Line Road and 82nd Street, the home of freighter and co-founder of the Pony Express, Alexander Majors. Both are under the direction of Anna Marie Tutera, who grew up in Kansas City and recently returned to become executive director of the Warnell Majors House Museums. Anna Marie Tutera, welcome to Central Standard Friday.
Thank you for having me.
And with her today is Hibbard Klein, a member of the board and treasurer of the Warnell Majors House Museums. He's a lawyer and a soon-to-be-published history buff. Welcome, Hib Klein.
Thank you, Monroe. It's nice to be here.
So let's take these two houses one at a time, if we may. Let's begin with the John Warnell House. The address is 6115 Warnell Road. Now, anybody driving Warnell Road today really can't miss it. There are plenty of houses on Warnell that are nearly a century old themselves, yet the John Warnell House is quite unlike any of the rest. Tell us how it got there.
Well, John Warnell and his family moved from Kentucky to Missouri in the 1840s. And his parents actually purchased 500 acres from John McCoy, who was the founder of Westport. And after his parents died, John was really the sole proprietor of the land.
And today we see trees and stately houses and streets laid out. And when the Warnell family bought this land in the 1840s, it was simply what?
It was simply farmland.
Pasture, few trees,
absolutely,
prairie.
Absolutely.
But it had one very important asset, and that was what's now Warnell Road, which was the main route out of Westport where the trains started, the wagon trains, for the Santa Fe Trail. And so in real estate, location is everything. And John Warnell was able to, or his father, was able to pay off the $25,000 purchase price of the property from the first year's production of the land, selling fodder and grain to the wagons as they went by. So they were a very important part of the westward expansion of the United States.
Mm-hmm. And the Santa Fe Trail was a commercial deal where people were carrying freight down there and bringing money and other things back. And so these guys were helping guys outfit for taking off on the trail.
Mm-hmm. They were, and this is a tie-in to the Majors House as well, because Alexander Majors was one of the pioneers that started the great freight business between Westport and Santa Fe right after the Mexican War.
Now, the Warnell House was in the orbit, I guess, so the nearest town was a town called Westport. Now, Westport's an entertainment district, part of Kansas City, but then what was Westport like?
Westport was the jumping-off place for the California Trail, the Oregon Trail, the Santa Fe Trail, and the Mormon Trail. You could get to Kansas Landing, what is now Kansas City, by riverboat. So it was faster, more convenient, and a lot more comfortable to come from the east that far. But then the Missouri River turns north, so you weren't gaining anything by staying on the river. So people would get off the boats at Kansas Landing, what is now Kansas City, and go to Westport and buy their team, oxen usually, a wagon, and their supplies, both for themselves and for their animals, and start the arduous trip west, whether it was northwest to Oregon or southwest to Santa Fe or west to California.
Because there were no paved roads. It was all just bumpy trail.
And you followed the tracks that were left from last year's people that made it, and you'd go by the remains of those that didn't make it, the skeletons of oxen, the wagons that were abandoned. So it could be a rather daunting process.
Now, the Warnell family, John Warnell bought it from his father at some point in all of this before the Civil War and before the what we think of today as the Warnell home was built.
Right. It was built in 1856, actually. And it was built in the Greek Revival style. Mm-hmm. And at the time, I believe it was known to be one of the most pretentious properties in the area.
In fact, I think I've read that John Warnold wanted it just that way.
Right, right, exactly. But all of the bricks were hand-fired on the property. And I believe it cost about $5,000 to build that house at the time. Can you imagine that?
Now, did they have an architect and a contractor? Or how does a house like that get built out on the prairie?
Well, there were some people that said they were architects, but they weren't what we would think of today as a trained architect. They were master carpenters.
Mm. Right.
And they would oversee a rough drawing, a concept of what they wanted to do, and the detail work, the woodwork, et cetera. But John Warnold really was his own prime contractor mm-hmm. for the property. He hired people to haul sand from the river. He built the kiln, which was to the east and down toward the park down there, mm-hmm. To make the bricks. He hired workers to work on the project. So he was the prime contractor.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a man named Wiley Britton who has written about this in the Missouri Historical Review. A little Googling came upon him. He helped make the bricks, and they even laid the bricks in different patterns depending on which side was showing. Is that right?
Yes. The Flemish bond was used out front because it was more attractive. And then as you got to the back, they used a different bond. And this was a way of laying the bricks so that you would have the parallel running bricks, and then on the next layer up, you'd go crossways, and this would secure the – make the wall stronger. This was fairly common in certainly the West and really throughout American society, that you would have a good carpet in the parlor, and then as it got worn, it would move to the kitchen or the dining room, and then eventually it would be cut in strips and used up in the bedroom. So you wanted to show the best image, but you didn't throw things away.
Long before an era in which we call that repurposing.
Yes.
Now, in the 1850s in particular, the border right there between Kansas Territory and Missouri, pretty touchy, pretty dangerous place to be operating a farm. There were bushwhackers, there were jayhawkers. There's a lot of scariness about it.
Well, it was not that way until you got to the Kansas-Nebraska Act in 1854. Before that, Kansas was Indian Territory. Missouri was the northern slave state, and the Missouri Compromise of 1820, the southern border of Missouri, extended west. Slave states below that line, free above that line. Senator Douglas of Illinois wanted to get the Democratic nomination for president, and there was a contest about between the Northern Democratic Party and the Southern Democratic Party, so over westward expansion. So he said, well, let's just let the territories vote as they come into statehood on whether they're slave or free. And this was passed by the Congress into law. And what it meant was we no longer had an agreement. We had a free-for-all. And so the Missourians were trying to go into Kansas because it was prime land. New England Emigrant Aid Society, abolitionist movement in the North, wanted to counter that. So it was almost like the French and the British in the 18th century in North America. You had this great competition, which turned violent fairly quickly. And really the Civil War started in the mid-50s on the Kansas-Missouri border.
And we call those disputes today quite the thing. But in those days, to be living down there around that, it must have been kind of dicey.
Very dicey. At one point, Mr. Warnell was strung up by the neck on his own front porch and cut down just in time. And at that point, they decided they were going to move into town until things settled down.
You're listening to Central Standard Friday on KCUR. I'm Monroe Dodd, and with us this morning are Anna Marie Tutera, director of the Warnell Major Houses and Museums, and Hib Klein, who's on the board of that organization. I've read that John Warnell was in a group in Westport called the Minutemen. John Warnell was a slaveholder, which was not uncommon in those days for prosperous people.
Well, the slavery in Missouri and really in most of the South. If you look at the 1860 census, 6% of Southerners owned slaves, or slightly under 6%. Of that, slightly under 3% owned more than five. So the Warnell slavery situation, I believe he had was the largest number of slaves he had at one time. And these would be people that you would labor, that you would obtain to help around the house, on the farm, often because the death rate of children was so high that if somebody got an infection, we didn't have antibiotics, so you needed to have a way of filling in this labor pool, and the free population tended to go off on their own and set up their own little farm, and so this was one way of guaranteeing a labor pool, and they worked often as a hired man would work. It was not something like Gone with the Wind.
Now, we have a caller on that very topic, Joe in Kansas City, Missouri. Good morning, Joe.
Good morning. Yes, I was wondering about where the slave quarters or cabins may have been located on the property, and I find it kind of interesting that as an African-American who, may have had some somewhere along the line ancestors who were slaves, and I think a couple of years ago, as a member of the Kansas City, Missouri Landwatch Commission, we approved some work to be done on the Warnell House, and I kind of smiled and, thought back to those days when slaves may have said this may never happen. But what was may have been some of the locations of the slave cabins around the Warnell House?
From what I recall, they were to the northeast of the house, I can't guarantee you that that's accurate, but that's my recollection. If you'd like to come out to the house, I believe we have some diagrams that may be helpful, and you can certainly call our number. Do you have that, Anna-Marie?
444-1858.
Oh, should remember 1858 is when the house was built. If you'd like to give us a call, we can look it up and see if we can give you a little more detail on exactly where they were.
And
I would appreciate that very much. It's most interesting since I attended a lecture last night at the about Thomas Jefferson and his slaves, and where they were housed was most interesting.
Yeah, and Joe, actually, I was going to say that is, for me, as the new executive director, that is a piece, and a really important educational piece of the history of the Warnell House that I definitely want to explore more, especially as we do outreach programs for children and youth as well. So we'll be investigating that a little bit more and building some programming around that slave history.
I sure thank you for the information, and I look forward to receiving something about that subject.
Can you give us a contact?
Maybe he could give that off the air.
Okay, great.
It'd be better. Joe, thank you very much for your call. The important men on either side of the state line often knew one another. The families travel in the same circles. John Warnell's second wife was the daughter of Thomas Johnson, the man for whom Johnson County is named,
right,
and for whom the Shawnee Indian Mission, well, that was his project. They moved in money circles, farming circles, banking circles. There was a kind of a camaraderie among those folks across the border in those days.
I think that's very true. Of course, across the border, up until the Kansas-Nebraska Act, was Indian territory.
Mm-hmm.
So settlement was not encouraged or really permitted. So only people that would be across the border would be people like Reverend Johnson who were missionaries or working with the Indians.
Mm-hmm. And he married Johnson's daughter. And then Johnson came to an not getting too far from the John Warnell House here, but Johnson came to an untimely end in January of 1865. And as I understand it, the Warnell family got really nervous about that.
Well, the Warnell family, after Order Number 11 came out, moved into Kansas City, and we've got two different addresses for where they lived, but it was down somewhere either on Locust or the 9th and Main area, but in very close to the River Market area, which was really what Kansas Landing, Kansas City was. But the Quantrill raid on Lawrence in 1863 resulted in General Order Number 11, which was to depopulate the counties south of Kansas City or Westport along the border, state borders. And they forced people to evacuate to three towns that had Union garrisons if they were pro-Union, or to depart the area within 15 days. And then the Kansans came over and enforced the order with great vigor, burning houses, all the houses, burning the barns, driving off the livestock, and destroying the crops in the fields. So it was a scorched earth policy, and the Warnells went into Kansas City.
In 1864, when Sterling Price brought a Confederate raiding party, actually a fairly large force, through this area, and the Battle of Westport occurred, during that battle, this house served both sides as a hospital.
Mm-hmm. Yes, the provisions for wounded were rather rudimentary in the Civil War. And so what you would do is find any structure that could be used as a hospital, and you would clear the area of unnecessary things such as church pews or furniture, and bring in wounded, and they would be quite crowded conditions. There were no antibiotics. There was limited pain medication, especially on the southern side, and the main treatment was amputation for wounded limbs. If it was a torso wound, often those were considered fatal, especially if it was abdominal. So you had crowding, infection, misery, suffering, and the Warnell House was used first by the Confederates, and then as Price withdrew down Warnell Road, the Union took over, and at one point the Confederates that were too badly wounded to be moved were being killed by the Union forces in the Warnell House, and Mrs. Warnell came out of the basement and pleaded, and so they stopped that.
And all on the same day this happened. Now, today you can go in this house and look around and get a feel for life in the 1850s and 60s, and especially for family life, Anna Marie.
Absolutely. I mean, we have period artifacts, furniture, fixtures, and it's really an incredible journey into the past. I mean, to get a chance to see how the Warnells lived, to understand what they did on a daily basis. You know, when we have children come to the museum, we often have them engaged in activities like candle dipping, you know, or during camp we had them do some sheep shearing, I believe. And it's an opportunity for them to really get a sense that history is actually made of people, you know, to actually understand what people did at that time in comparison to modern day life. I think it's really fascinating and an important part for children to learn.
You mean they couldn't just turn on a light, an electric light in those days?
Right. You know, that people wrote letters,
mm-hmm.
you know, that people did candle wicking and embroidery, and there were parlor games, you know, and that people read, and storytelling was a vibrant part of everyday life.
Now, you have holiday specials at the Warnell House, as I think at both houses. Tell us a little bit about the one holiday coming up is Halloween.
Yeah, we do. Well, right now we're in the second weekend of doing our ghost tours and paranormal investigations. And we've been doing those for the past couple of years. And it's really an opportunity. The ghost tours are really an opportunity for people to come to the Warnell House and be led by lantern light by our docents, and really get a sense of some of the experiences that staff members and others have had in the house encountering ghosts, basically. And then in the evening, late into the evening, we have paranormal investigations. So we have real investigators come and do real-time ghost hunting.
As in Ghostbusters, they must have lots of sophisticated gear.
They do. They have sophisticated gear. And it's I have to tell you, it's really interesting. It's very interesting. And there have been investigators actually in both houses for several years.
Now, at Christmas time, you have a couple occasions where you really can get a real feel for it. Everything's lit only by candles.
Right.
People are reenacting, I believe.
Exactly. And it's a very kind of theatrical, interactive tour of the Warnell house. It's to really get a sense of how the Warnells might have spent Christmas Eve together. So every room, there's kind of a different scene. Mm-hmm. Of life in that night. There's music and dancing. It's kind of a multi-sensory experience. We have cooking, open hearth cooking demonstrations. We have parlor games, tableau, and it's a really fun evening.
Let's talk a little bit about what happened after the Civil War. We know John Warnell got into banking, I believe, and a little politics and some real estate, but the family kept living in this house for decades.
They did. And actually, one thing that I was going to say is when you think about the Warnell House being a field hospital, you do have to remember that there were children present. I mean, John and Elijah had 7 children, mm-hmm. 5 of whom died. And then he and Roma, his third wife, actually went on to have 2 children. So when I think about that time, I imagine the presence of children in that house experiencing.
Well, Eliza and her 9-year-old son sheltered in the root cellar, which was under the kitchen, because the bullets were quite close. And so they were down there until the Union forces entered, and she came up and then began to help with the wounded. And that's when she stopped the shooting of the Confederates that had been left behind. We do have, in conjunction with KU Medical Center, a very detailed and I think quite excellent reenactment of the Warnell House as a field hospital, mm-hmm. Where we talk about the medicines, about disease, about the various tools that the medical people used, and then they have a reenactment where reenactors have moulages on them, and they will actually extract a projectile from a wound. It's very well done.
When do these take place, these reenactments?
We have them. When is this?
We try to do them annually. Huh. We will probably plan to do another one in the spring.
These would be open to the public to go
absolutely.
Watch them?
Oh,
yes, and we will advertise them through places like KCUR and and encourage attendance.
Now, these children inherited the house and lived in it. It was lived in by members of the family into the 1960s. Is that right?
That's right. But what I think is really interesting about the history is that after John's term in the Senate, Roma returned to the Warnell House, mm-hmm. and that was about in 1870s. Mm-hmm. And but she didn't live there for very long, and because they bought a house, and Hib was it over in like 9th and Main?
That I thought was where they went when General Order Number 11 went out, but I don't know where the house
was. Yeah, I think they bought a house and they lived in that house for a period of time, and then Roma actually sold the farm to J.C. Nichols, mm-hmm. in 1910. And then he turned that into the site for the Pembroke Country Day School for the Boys.
And all around, he was building his country club district that would make him famous for housing developments and things.
And so she had gone to live in an apartment, but she didn't like that very much. And so she came back and returned to the house, actually, and lived there until she died in 1933.
Hmm. And the family had it till 1964.
That's right.
Well, this is great on the John Warnell House for now, and we'll move on after the break to another famous house in the area, a long historical house. You are listening to Central Standard Friday, and we'll be back with Anna Marie Tutera and Hib Klein. Welcome Welcome back to Central Standard Friday. I'm Monroe Dodd. We're talking about two of the area's oldest buildings, the John Warnell House and Museum on Warnell Road and the Alexander Majors Home on State Line Road, and the important part of our Kansas City past that they represent. Our guests are Anna Marie Tutera and Hib Klein. You can join this conversation and ask questions about the era, the house, the Civil War, you name it, we can try to attack it, by calling 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Or you can email your questions at centralstandard@kcur.org. Now let's move over to the other house that's in your purview, Anna Marie. The Alexander Majors House, the big white wooden building down on State Line Road, it too is hard to miss.
Right. And we actually, we merged with that organization in 2011.
How was it preserved over the years? It dates back to the 1850s also. These places somehow survive.
It does. Actually, Alexander Majors lived in that house for about 2 years. And I would say that it was preserved mostly by his great-granddaughter, Louisa Johnston, who really worked hard to make sure that that house was restored, that it was respected as this treasure in Kansas City, that it would be open to the public and be accessible. And when she died, it was then taken over by the Chapman family until Terry Chapman, who was an architect, died just a few years ago. Is that correct, Hib?
I believe so, yes.
Yes. And then we had the opportunity to merge with that museum because it fit perfectly into our mission. And the two houses just absolutely complement each other.
Now, this was the house of Alexander Majors. Let's talk a little bit about him. He ran a freighting operation, meaning wagons and mules and oxen, to carry stuff for hire to Santa Fe and to Utah, too.
Well, and he had contracts with the government, with the Army, to supply the troops along the Santa Fe Trail, and also to supply the Indians who had been resettled into Kansas Territory and further west from the east. So a lot of their work was government contract work. They were a huge undertaking. He had two partners, William Russell and William Waddell. So Russell Major Waddell was the sprint of the period. They would have thousands of oxen and hundreds of wagons, and these were great freight wagons, and move things to California, to Santa Fe, and up into Salt Lake. And after California became a state, Mr. Russell was in Washington, because the way it was divided up, Russell was the governmental relations office of the firm. Mm-hmm. Waddell was the accountant and number-crunching businessman of the firm. And Alexander Majors was the guy that went out and got his boots dirty and made sure the wagons rolled and the oxen were in good health and the ox drivers were sober and, you know, made it happen. Mm-hmm. Well, Mr. Russell was back in Washington, and Senator Gill of California said, we have a real problem with trying to connect California with the rest of the nation, and we need a way to get mail out there. Mm-hmm. And Russell leaped on this and said, well, we can set up some riders to do this, and came back, and Majors and Waddell went, what? Do you realize what we'd have to charge for a letter? This is a really risky business. Plus, there's this talk about this telegraph thing that Samuel F.B. Morse came up with, and, you know, how long is this Pony Express thing going to work? Well, I've given my word, said Russell. And they said, well, in that case, we'll do it. And they set up the Pony Express. It lasted for, I think, about 18 months and then failed because the telegraph got across the continent. And the result was a major economic setback for Russell's Majors Waddell.
And, in fact, the business kind of did poorly after a while, but the combination of the telegraph and the railroads took away a lot of their work.
And the late unpleasantness of the Civil War.
Mm-hmm. Now we have a caller, Kathy from Lee's Summit. Good morning, Kathy.
Good morning. What a wonderful topic. My question is, I am friends with someone who owns property out in Lone Jack, and the documentation that he has regarding that property is that his relatives purchased that from the Majors Russell Waddell bankruptcy, and there actually are wagon ruts on there, and he tells us that he can remember, well, he's in his mid-90s right now, he's told us that he remembers when he was a child, a cousin telling him about the a shed where oxen yokes were stacked clear to the ceiling of this particular shed. So I wondered, in your research, and maybe you haven't had time to do this, have you been able to connect that property out there in Lone Jack, which, by the way, is located on Buckner-Tarsney Road, to Majors Russell and Waddell and their operation? The property out there did have its own natural spring, and of course they would have, the oxen would have needed that for the watering and so forth, and of course it was grassy, and it was quite a vast acreage, so it had all the essential things that they would have needed, plus it was very close to Lexington, being on the Buckner-Tarsney Road, and as you know, they also had an operation there in Lexington. So do you have any information for me on that?
I don't have any information, Kathy, on that particular spot. I do know that they were very active in Lexington. Lexington was a major town before the Civil War. I think it had 11 banks in the town, and it was in large part its wealth came from the hemp trade to make the sacking for cotton when the cotton bales were wrapped, and also mm-hmm. from providing support for the westward expansion. So it is very, very probable that the Lone Jack area would have had a pasturing area and a staging area for the wagon trains of this great freight company.
And that's what we surmised, due to the depths of the wagon ruts, and they run all over his property, and it's actually pretty fantastic. But I'm so glad that now both of the entities have joined together, and both of you are working very hard to preserve those important sites in Kansas City. So thank you for your hard work, and I know it's very hard work.
Thank you, Kathy. We do, in preserving these two houses, the social sciences don't have the ability to use beakers and measure and metrics, et cetera. The only laboratory we have, as Napoleon said, is history.
Yes.
History is our laboratory. And these houses represent a time when this country was very polarized, and we are today quite polarized. So this is a very great asset to look back at the way these highly intelligent, very well-informed people tried to deal with a polarized society, and maybe there are some lessons for us today as we try to resolve our differences.
I agree, and I fight the preservation fight here in Lee Summit all the time. I'm the Historical Society. I'm also on the Preservation Commission, so I know sometimes it can be an upward battle, but preserving those two sites and what the tourism traffic that can bring to Kansas City is just phenomenal. So once again, thank you for your good work, and thank you for taking my call today.
Thank you, Kathy.
Okay, take care. Bye-bye.
You know, Hib, I'm really glad that you made that point, because as I think about, moving the museum forward, and I think about the programming that we can do there and how we can really extend ourselves into the community, I think that both houses are really not only a point of entry into our past, but a real point of departure for kind of contemporary discourse on issues such as race and class and culture, economic development, entrepreneurship. And so I think that there is so much opportunity just with the history of both of these men and their families to really reach an audience in a different way that we have in the past.
You can join us with your questions or comments by calling 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Or by emailing us at centralstandard@kcur.org. Why was the Alexander Majors house put right down there on state lines, so far from Westport, from Kansas City, out in the country? How did he select that property?
Well, he was in a business of livestock. Really, until the railroads came out here, except for the steamboats on the river, energy conversion to productive work was muscle. Mm-hmm. And if you're feeding a 1,200-pound ox, you need a lot of grass. Fescue or Kentucky blue stamp is what I'm talking about. So you needed land. And so he was moving out to areas where he could support these vast herds of oxen and some mules. So he needed that. He also, very cleverly, was on the state line because he could then graze these things in Kansas. And, of course, Missouri was a state and had property tax, and so you were taxed on your livestock. But if they're across over there in Kansas territory, it didn't have a tax on personal property yet, so he didn't have to pay tax on 10,000 oxen. It made a difference in Mr. Waddell's numbers for the bottom line.
And his house was hard by the actual state line. It's a little bit of ways from State Line Road, but the actual line is right there.
10 feet in front of the front steps.
And we actually, in the house, we actually have a fantastic artifact. We have a wheel hub that I think was actually excavated across over in Kansas by where the, I think there's a Baptist church there now.
There's a very large church, and that's built on, I'm sure, some very rich soil because thousands of oxen were kept there.
So did he use the house for the 2 years he lived in it as the headquarters of his freighting operation?
Yes. Yep. If you come into the front door and turn right, the room there was his office, and there's a separate door so he could go out of the office mm-hmm. without having to go through the family quarters.
Okay, I see. Let's go to Suzanne in Overland Park now. Good morning, Suzanne.
Hi, thanks for taking my call, and I love history, and I'm so glad that the Warnell Home and Alexander Majors have combined efforts. My concern was I have been there many times, and I noticed when they were doing some preservation, it appears that you replaced all of the original windows. The old glass window panes, and my understanding was those were original. You could still see the waviness through them. But now it looks like they're all replaced. Can you comment on that?
You know, I think the glazing is the original glazing, but we had to redo the windows because the frames and sills had become very punky and rotten and were falling apart. And so we've been through a major project to redo the windows, but I'm not positive on this, but I would be very surprised if we didn't preserve the original glazing. So we can check on that, Suzanne.
I'll
talk. Okay.
Well, I just didn't look like the glass panes were the same, but you know.
Okay.
Well, but thank you,
Suzanne. Thank you for your call. Let's go now to Evelyn in Kansas City. Good morning, Evelyn.
Good morning. I'm concerned about what happened to the wagon, the covered wagon on the campus of Alexander Major Home.
The wagon is mm-hmm. a great landmark. It's been there for decades. It was in dangerous, dangerous shape. It was literally falling apart.
Mm-hmm.
And a matter of fact, we had an event out there, and during the event, part of it tipped over.
And okay.
So
I noticed that when I passed there one day. Uh-huh.
And we looked at, fixing it, and it parts of it were an old fiberglass, and it just was not fixable.
Okay.
So we're hoping to replace it with some artwork of some sort, possibly metal silhouette cutouts like the
mm-hmm.
Cattle down by the stockyards,
right.
to bring back the idea of a wagon and ox team.
Okay.
But the funding priority is preservation of the houses, and then once we've got the rotten window sills and
mm-hmm.
the cracks in the mortar replaced,
right.
then we'll worry about that. But
okay.
Yes, it was a landmark, but
it was a landmark. Mm-hmm.
It had gone from being a landmark to becoming actually a hazard for the groups that we had at the house.
Okay, well, thank you,
Evelyn. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Bye bye.
Unlike the John Warnell house, where the bricks were made on site, the Alexander Major's house was of lumber. Was it local stuff?
I believe so. I don't know if it was, within 5 miles or something, but I really don't have the answer to that, Monroe. I know that at the Warnell house, the lumber that was used was local, except for the white pine flooring, which was brought in. But I don't really know at the Major's house.
And
I was going to say, and I believe that the flooring on the second floor of the Warnell House is still original.
Yes.
Yeah. Wow, so you can go in there and get an idea of what the techniques were for building a house out here on the prairie in the frontier days. Alexander Major's operations also went, as I understand it, to Utah. He served the U.S. government, the military, the supply ports, and when he's going to Santa Fe, sometimes these wagon trains would have difficulties with the Native Americans, whose territory they were going through. And on the way to Utah, they had difficulties, as I understand it, with the Mormons.
I don't have the details on that, Monroe, but I know that there was always a problem on the trail with the Native Americans, and also the potential for a problem with just people that saw these as good pickings.
Mm-hmm. As I understand, the United States government was getting concerned about the Mormons in Utah for right or wrong reason, and sent troops, and the and sometimes groups would try to interrupt the supply trains, which would be Russell Majors and what else?
Well, the Mormons had moved out to the Kansas City area from upstate New York,
mm-hmm.
And there was a thing called the Mormon War in the 30s out here where the Mormons were driven from the area and went out to Salt Lake. So there was a tension throughout the first half of the 19th century.
You're listening to Central Standard Friday on KCMUR. I'm Monroe Dodd, here with Anna Marie Tutera and Hib Klein of the John Warnell and Alexander Majors Houses and Museums. You can ask these folks a question or make a comment on those two places by calling us at 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Now, Alexander Majors moved his operations out of this area by the time of the Civil War. Is that right?
I'm not sure about that. I thought they were still in the area, and they had the Pony Express going.
Out of St. Joseph.
Out of St. Right. Joseph. But I wasn't aware that he had closed down the trains or anything.
Then I am wrong.
I just don't know. I don't know.
He also gave a very famous American showman his first job when he was a teenage boy.
Yes, an orphan boy at the age of 11 came to him and said, I have to support my family and I really need a job. I can't read, I can't write, but I'm good with horses and I'm a good shot. And he said, well, Willie Cody, you can work for me. And so young William Cody started working around the trains, and then when the Pony Express came along, was one of the Pony Express riders. And, of course, he went on to be Buffalo Bill Cody. He was a Union scout during the Civil War. And then the great Wild West show that toured all over the United States and also in Europe. Queen Victoria saw it perform in England. And he is the guy that really commercialized the American West and the cowboy and Indian story. And when I was a kid in upstate New York, we had a building torn down, and what they found on the neighboring building was one of the great murals that they used to advertise Bill Cody's Wild West show.
And he discovered a man named Alexander Majors living in something dire straits out in Denver once, and years later.
Majors, after the Civil War, went on hard times and died a pauper. Mm-hmm. I believe, I don't know the story of Cody finding him in Denver, but
he died a pauper in Chicago?
Chicago, I believe,
right.
Yes.
Wow, that was quite a turn of events for him. The house, meanwhile, suburbanization took a while to reach 82nd and State Line until after World War II. And yet, once again, this house stayed standing, apparently, as a result of the efforts of the descendants in that time. And it was restored when?
I think it was first restored in 1984. And then they went on to build the wagon room and the barn, which I think is actually built on the original barn foundation. And that's also where we have the forge and the blacksmith workshop, which I'm not sure is really widely known in the community, that we have this operative forge.
Hmm. Do you have reenactors working in it?
Absolutely. We have workshops, and we'll be doing much more of that as we start to really reopen this house, because we've been taking the past year to really get it up to speed, mm-hmm. with its collections and its restorations, as Hib was talking about. And so right now we're only open 2 days a week, but we'll start to open the house more over the next 6 to 9 months.
Speaking of day-to-day life, Nancy in Lee's Summit has a question for us. Good morning, Nancy. Hello, Nancy. I'm sorry, I must have pressed the wrong button on the way.
Hello?
Hello, Nancy?
Yeah, I don't know what happened. I must have cut you off. Oh, well. I'm glad you're back. I have a question. I don't know if it's actually within your area of expertise, but I've been told that in crossing over from, you know, the Midwest to the great out west, that the men usually had sturdy boots and the women walked the most part of the way barefoot. Is that true or is that an old wives' tale?
I don't know.
Yeah, me neither.
They would have had to have awfully calloused feet to do that, I think.
That was my original thought as well. But when I was told this, show, this is fact, so I thought, well, maybe your experts could give me some enlightenment on that. But, oh, well.
Okay. Well, Nancy, I do know that shoes were very poor quality compared to today's shoes, and they wore out very quickly.
Yes, yeah, I would imagine.
So I could see people setting out from Westport and, you know, somewhere in the middle of the plains, finally throwing the thing away because the sole was flapping and tripping them more than protecting their feet. Women of the poorest strata of society often did not have shoes in the early half, first half of the 19th century, or you would have shoes that you would wear at events, but you went barefoot the rest of the time. And people sometimes would have their shoes around their neck, and they'd walk into town, and then to go to church, they'd put their shoes on. But shoes were expensive, and so you didn't wear them when you were walking the 2 miles into town.
Well, I'm glad I'm living in this day and age. With all its problems, I have shoes. this has been a very interesting show, and I do plan to make a trip down there and visit your Morrill House. Sounds
wonderful.
Very interesting.
Thank you.
Very good.
Okay,
thank you. Thank you, Nancy. Let's go now to Foster in Brookside. Good morning, Foster.
Good morning. A very interesting show, and I did not hear the original part relative to the Warnell House, but I have a question relative to that, and that I live in that area, right, and probably on the grounds of the Warnell House on 62nd Street. My question is, I've been looking for photos, early photos of the grounds of the Warnell House and what that whole Warnell community might have been with the barns and outbuildings and that type of thing. Have not been able to find them. Wondered if the guests had any direction on that.
You know, we really don't have very many photos from that time. What I can tell you, just because you were kind of talking about the boundaries, is that entire farmland, the boundaries were really now 59th Street to 67th Street and Maine to State Line.
Right.
And I believe that the barn was actually on the corner of 63rd and Brookside, which there's now a CVS there.
And I've been very surprised at that. That's a long walk. And that meant to me that they had servants. You know, mm-hmm. Somebody needed to attend to the barn, and that's a waste.
That's exactly right. And so, you know, if you come by the Warnell House you actually make an appointment, I can show you what we do have in our archives, the documentation that we do have, which might be interesting for you to see, maps and such.
That would be great. Well, I will make it a point to do that. It's just a walk around the block.
All right.
I really appreciate the show. It's wonderful. I'm going to go back and get this online so I can hear the whole thing. Thanks very much.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you, Foster. There was an atlas done of Jackson County in the 1870s in which there were lots of engravings of various people's farms. I wonder if the Warnell operation was still alive in that. And I've seen sometimes people will lift pictures and things from it. 1874, 1875, if there's anybody with the Jackson County Historical Society out there listening, they can call and either correct me or support that. But he might be able to find it that way.
Sure.
That's a good thought.
Well, and then just kind of another interesting piece for me, too, is thinking about the portraits that were actually painted. You know, George Caleb Bingham, who is, you know, obviously a very prominent artist of the time, he actually painted portraits of John and Eliza and Roma. And his portrait of Roma is actually in the Nelson's collection. And John and Eliza's portraits are actually held by the Warnell family at this time.
So they're not on public display?
No, they're not.
Oh, that's interesting. Now, you have holiday programs at the Alexander Majors House as well as
We do. Absolutely. We have an annual event that's called Candlelight, and that is on December 7th and 8th this year, and that's that interactive tour that I was telling you about. And then we're actually doing a Father Christmas event this year at the Majors House on December 15th. So that's an opportunity for kids to meet Father Christmas, have their picture taken, and engage in some hands-on traditional Victorian Christmas activities.
Well, y'all are doing a lot of good work, and that's all the time we have for today's show. We've been talking about two people, John Warnell and Alexander Majors, and their families and the times they represented, people whose homes survive in Kansas City. Our guests have been Anna Marie Tutera, who's executive director of the two houses, and Hib Klein, a longtime historian, lawyer, and other things about town. Thank you both, Hib and Anna Marie, for being with us this morning.
Thank you so much.
Now, for more information on our guests and upcoming shows, visit our website, kcur.org. Central Standard Friday was produced today by Maria Carter. Our announcer is Kim Noble. I'm Monroe Dodd. Tune in to Central Standard Friday next week for the Food Critics, and enjoy your day.